Chapter 30. For the rest of the day I worked steadily in my office. The rain began again, coming down heavily all afternoon. Barrack was there too, in no mood for conversation, occasionally wincing, probably at the pains in his head after his drinking bout. So far as I was concerned, he deserved them. Towards evening a rider came from Cranmer's office, summoning me to a conference at Lambeth the following afternoon. I reflected there could have been no dramatic developments, or he would have wanted to see me at once. It must be our lack of progress he wished to discuss. I went to bed early. It rained heavily again in the night, and I woke a couple of times to hear it pattering on the roof. I thought of the killer, out there somewhere. He could be watching the house now, for rain and cold meant little to him. Or he could be sitting in some room somewhere in the vast city, listening to the rain as I was, while heaven knew what thoughts went through his mind. Next morning was fine and sunny again, the warmest day so far. The spring was moving on. Sitting at breakfast, I saw Tamsin walking on her own around the garden, pausing to look at the crocuses and the daffodils. She walked back towards the house and sat on the bench next to the kitchen door. I went outside to join her. Her bruises were quite gone now, her face strikingly pretty once again. But she looked preoccupied. She half rose as I approached, and I waved her to stay seated. "Is that bench not wet?" I asked. "It's kept dry by the eaves." "Your garden is beautiful," she added wistfully. "I have had a lot of work done here over the years." "How is Jack this morning?" "I think he didn't go out again last night."
"No. He still had a sore head."
She took a deep breath.
"But he's apologised. He said what he told you, that when this business is over he will move us into a little house somewhere, perhaps even with a garden. He said it would give me something to do."
"I wish he'd told me first. Would that cheer you?"
"I would like a garden," she replied in a flat tone. "But I doubt we could afford that."
"Perhaps it's time I reviewed his salary."
"I'm surprised you don't dismiss him after how he has behaved in your house," she said with cold anger.
"We have all been under great strain, Tamsin."
"I know."
She looked at me seriously.
"But the troubles with Jack began long before this, as you know."
"He knows he's done wrong, Tamsin. When all this is over and you're settled somewhere else, things'll be better. You'll see." She shook her head.
"You know what a sharp tongue he has? He has sulked and got drunk and insulted me before. Then he's sorry and says he loves me, and then he does it again and says he's sorry again, and so it goes on. It's our lost child that's driven us apart."
"There are worse husbands," I said quietly. "He doesn't beat you."
"Am I to be grateful for that?"
"Give him time, Tamsin."
"Sometimes I think, why should I bear this? I even think of leaving. Only I have nowhere to go."
She bit her lip.
"I shouldn't burden you with this, sir."
"Only you have no one else." I looked at her seriously. "For what it's worth, I think you should remember Jack is under great pressure now."
"I used to admire his adventurousness, at the same time as I wanted him to settle down. After this, I think he'll be only too happy to live a quiet life. But will he want to live it with me?"
"I believe so. I'm sorry, it was I who involved him in all this, because my friend was killed." She looked at me.
"How's his widow?"
"She's strong, but the weight of grief still lies full on her." Tamsin gave me a searching look. I wondered if she had divined something of my feelings for Dorothy. I rose. "I have to do some work, then go to Lambeth Palace."
"The Archbishop,"
Yes.
Take care, sir, she said.
And you, Tamasin. You take care too. I left her and went round to the stables. I decided not to take Barak with me. Left alone together, perhaps he and Tamasin might be able to talk more. I would have been reluctant to walk to Westminster alone, but felt safer on my horse, though I hadn't had that sense of someone following me lately. I felt sorry for Tamasin. Sorry for Barak too now. I thought again of Dorothy. Doubts came into my mind. My feelings for her might have lain dormant all these years, but there was no reason she should ever feel as strongly. Yet, perhaps in time. I told myself I must wait and see how things developed over the months to come. Young Timothy was in the stable, scraping dung-laden old straw into a pail. A batch of new straw stood by the door. Genesis stood in his stall, looking on placidly. I was glad to see the horse was at ease with the boy. How are you faring, Timothy?
Well, sir.
He smiled, a flash of white teeth in his dirty face. It was the first time I had seen him smile.
Master Orr has been teaching me and Peter our letters.
Ah, yes, I saw him with Peter. It is good to know them.
Yes, sir. Only...
Yes?
He talks about God all the time.
I thought, and you will have little time for God after your experiences at Yarrington's. You and Peter are getting along? I asked, changing the subject.
Yes, sir. So long as I leave him to his work and stick to mine.
Good. You seem to have made friends with Genesis.
He's an easy horse.
He hesitated.
Do you know, sir, what became of Master Yarrington's horse?
I'm afraid not. Someone will buy him. Timothy looked crestfallen. I don't need another horse, I said. Now come, saddle Genesis for me. I rode out, thinking how sad it was that the child's only friend had been Yarrington's horse. But I drew the line at buying it for him. The stable wasn't large enough apart from anything. I pulled aside hastily to avoid a grey-bearded peddler pushing a cartload of clothes. Waifs and strays, I thought, and beggars and peddlers. Everywhere. The hospital. When this was over, I must set to work on the hospital. The ride to Westminster Stairs took longer than usual, for the streets were waterlogged and one or two were flooded. I heard people saying the Tyburn had overflowed in its upper reaches, flooding the fields. I noticed a printer's shop, closed and shuttered, and wondered if the owner had been taken away by Bonner's men. When I arrived in Cranmer's office at Lambeth Palace, the atmosphere was tense. All the men of power who had involved themselves in this grim quest were gathered. Harsnett stood near the door, looking downcast. Lord Hertford stood opposite, stroking his long beard, anger in his prominent eyes. His brother, Sir Thomas, stood next to him, arms folded, looking grim. As usual, he was dressed in bright, expensive clothes, a doublet in a bold green, the arms slashed to show a vermilion silk lining. Cranmer sat behind his desk in white robe and stole, his face severe. "I hope I'm not late, my lord." "I cannot stay long," he said. "There are matters I must attend to." He looked drawn and anxious. "Among them, trying to persuade the Privy Council to allow me to have Dean Benson in for questioning without saying why." He laughed bitterly. "When most of them would rather have me arrested than him." Hertford looked at me.
"We have been asking Coroner Harsnett how it is he cannot find this Goddard despite all the resources we have given him."
"It's easy to disappear in London," I said. Harsnett gave me a brief, grateful nod.
"But this man must have antecedents."
Hertford slapped a hand violently onto his desk, an unexpected gesture that made us all start.
"He must have come from somewhere before he joined the Abbey, or did he spring from the earth like some demon from hell?"
I don't believe his family are from within London, Harsnett said. I think they may have come from the nearer parts of Middlesex or Surrey or Kent. It must be near enough for him to ride into London. I'm still making inquiries with the officials of all those counties, but it takes time. Time is what we don't have, Cranmer said. There are still 3 more vials to be poured out, 3 more murders to come, and with each it gets harder to conceal what is happening. Cranmer looked at me sternly. Master Harsnett says you think there may be another suspect. Some young man who visited Yarrington's whore. The whore who escaped, he added, with a sidelong look at Harsnett. They were blaming him for everything. The lack of progress, the escape of the whore, and Lockley's vanishing. The fact he knew Yarrington kept a girl in his house makes this visitor a suspect, I said carefully. But there's nothing to link him to the other murders. Yet all the evidence against Goddard, too, is circumstantial. I glanced at Harsnett again, then back to the Archbishop. My lord, the man we seek is very clever. He seems to have made killing his life's mission. More like a man possessed by the devil than a madman, Lord Hartford observed. Was he too of Harsnett's way of thinking, I wondered? We don't know what he is, I answered.
Something new, Sir Thomas said. Well, the world is full of new things.
He gave a quick, cynical half-smile. I thought, this is like an interesting puzzle to him.
Maybe we should leave this man to fulfil his prophecy, he said. Concentrate on covering up the murders. When he's completed the 7, he'll stop, surely. Perhaps he thinks the world will come to an end then. When it doesn't, perhaps it'll be too much for him. Perhaps he'll kill himself.
I don't think someone so devoted to killing could stop, I said quietly.
I agree, Cranmer said. And how can we allow these outrages to continue?
He turned again to Harsnett.
How many men do you have at your disposal, Gregory?
4.
And you're circulating the names Cantrell supplied amongst the radical brethren?
Yes.
And now we need to find Lockley as well as that girl Abigail.
Cranmer considered.
You need more men. People who are competent to make these inquiries.
I dare not take men from my household. There are spies there now.
I need to be careful too, Lord Hartford agreed.
Perhaps I can help, Sir Thomas said. I have a household full of clever young men and a good steward. I could lend you a dozen if you like.
His brother and Cranmer exchanged glances. I could see that they were wondering how far he could be trusted. I wondered why he had made the offer. Perhaps for him this was an adventure now, the Turkish war on a small scale. Hartford hesitated, then nodded.
Very well, Thomas, Cranmer said. If you could make some men quietly available, that would help us greatly. But they must come under the direct supervision of Coroner Harsnett.
Seymour looked at the coroner.
My men are to be placed under the orders of a clerk?
If you want to be involved, yes,
Lord Hartford told him bluntly. Sir Thomas met his gaze for a moment, then shrugged.
I will use them well, Harsnett said. I can send them to the constables of all the villages round London, from Barnet and Enfield to Bromley and Surbiton, to find whether the name Goddard is known.
The Archbishop looked at Harsnett.
Perhaps I should have set this in train before, given you more resources.
I looked at him with respect. It was unheard of for anyone in power to admit a mistake. Harsnett nodded in gratitude.
And you, Matthew,
Cranmer added.
Keep thinking. Keep puzzling it over. That is your role.
And keep yourself and your household safe.
He put his hand to his mouth, kneading his lower lip between his finger and thumb.
"What will he do, do you think, when he has poured out the 7 vials?"
"Find a new theme for murder," I answered. "There are plenty in Revelation." Cranmer closed the meeting shortly after, asking the Seymour brothers to stay behind. Harsnett and I walked together along the dim passageways of the Archbishop's palace.
"These new men will be a great help," he said.
"Yes," I agreed. "Cranmer understands how hard you're working," I added.
"He's always most loyal to those who serve him. Yet I feel I let him down, letting the whore escape, then losing Lockley."
"I let the steward go, by the way. He knew nothing more."
"We all make mistakes, Gregory." He shook his head.
"I should have served him better, particularly with all the strain he's under now. You saw how troubled and afraid he is."
"No evidence of heresy has been found among his associates who were arrested."
"No, there would be none to find. The Archbishop is too cautious to hire men whom the papists would call heretics."
"Then perhaps he'll be safe. His enemies can't go to the king without evidence."
"They won't give up easily. And things are going badly in Parliament. The Act to prevent women and common folk from reading the Bible is progressing fast. But Christ and his saints will nevertheless win the final victory, for so we are told."
His tone became intense.
"The persecuted church is the true church."
He gave me a piercing look, suddenly the hot gospeler. "What news on Catherine Parr?" I asked to change the subject.
"Still, she won't agree to marry the king. They say she thinks on the fate of Catherine Howard. Better to think on God's will, the chance she has been given to influence the king."
"How can we ever be sure what God's will is?" He smiled, his severe mood gone as quickly as it had come.
"Oh, but one can, Matthew, if one prays.
As one day you will understand.
I'm sure of it."
I rode back along the riverbank to London Bridge. I passed the spot where we had found Dr. Gurney's body. In the distance I could see the squatters' cottages where Tupholm had been mutilated and left to die. That day the river sparkled in the spring sunshine, the beds of reeds behind the path soughing gently in a light breeze. I wondered if I would ever be able to appreciate the beauty of the vista again. I crossed the river at London Bridge and rode into town through the crowded streets. Though feeling much safer on horseback, I still looked around warily as I rode along. On the corner between Thames Street and New Fish Street, a pair of beggars sat underneath the new clock tower they were building there. No more than steps and scaffolding as yet. 2 sturdy-looking young men in ragged clothes and battered caps, they sat staring out at the crowd. A woman sat between them, also dressed in rags, her head cast down. As I passed, she looked up and I saw that she was beautiful. A young maid no more than 16. She met my eyes with a desolate look. I thought of the tooth drawers who would pay to destroy her face. The taller of the two young men saw my eyes meet hers. He stood up and took a couple of steps towards me.
"Don't you eye up, my sister," he shouted in a country accent. "Think you're fucking wonderful in your fine robe, don't you, fucking hunchback? Give us some money, we're starving."
I moved the horse along as fast as I could through the crowds. My heart thumped as I heard the beggar try to follow me through the crowd, a shower of insults and demands for money at my back. People turned and stared back at him.
"It costs money to look at normal people, bent back."
I looked over my shoulder. The beggar's friend had taken his arm and was pulling him back to the clock tower, afraid of attracting the constable. I moved on, glad the encounter hadn't taken place at night. The following morning I rode down to Guy's shop. I tied Genesis up outside and knocked at his door. Holding the reins had made my stitches pull again. I would be glad to have them out. Guy himself opened the door. To my surprise, he was wearing a pair of wood-framed spectacles. He smiled at my astonishment.
I need these for reading now. I am getting old. I used to take them off when visitors called, but I have decided that is the sin of vanity.
I followed him inside. Seeing his magnified eyes behind the glasses reminded me of Cantrell. I wondered how he was faring, stumbling about his miserable hovel. Guy had been sitting at his table. The big anatomical volume lay open there, revealing more gruesome illustrations. A quill and inkpot stood next to it. Guy had been making notes on a piece of paper. He invited me to sit. I took a stool at the table. Guy sat opposite me. He gestured to the book, which I had avoided looking at.
The more I study this text, the more I realize it changes everything.
There was excitement in Guy's voice.
All the old medical books we have been reading for hundreds of years, Galen and Hippocrates and the other Greeks and Romans, they have so much wrong. And if they are wrong on anatomy, may not everything else they say be called into question?
Beware the College of Physicians if you claim such things. To them, those books are holy writ.
But they are not holy writ.
They are the works of men, no more.
And they have become binds and fetters. No one may question them. At least, in your sphere of study, there are developments, changes, the law progresses.
Mostly at the pace of an old, tired snail. But, yes, it does.
I begin to see these old medical texts as no more than an infinite chaos of obscurities.
You could say that about the law, too.
But yes, we take so much ancient knowledge for granted, I said.
Like the Book of Revelation. Yet people need certainties more than ever in these disturbed and disoriented times. He frowned.
Even if those certainties bring hurt to them and others?
Do you know, I heard a tale the other day at the physician's hall of one of those end-timers who thinks Armageddon is almost upon us, who broke his leg and refused to have it treated, though the bone was sticking through the skin and it would become infected. He said he was certain his second coming would take place before he died. He thought his broken leg a test from God.
It's a paradox. Revelation, he said, how it has dominated Christian imagery.
I believe that many people thought the year 1000 was the end of time and stood on hills waiting for the end of the world.
What an evil book it is! For it says that humanity is nothing, is worth nothing.
He sighed, shook his head, then managed a sad smile.
How is your arm?
The stitches pull. I would like to have them out.
It has only been 5 days, he said doubtfully, but let me look.
He smiled warmly when I removed my robe and doublet and showed him my arm. It looked almost mended.
Piers did a good job there, and it has healed well. You're a fast healer, Matthew. Yes, I think those may come out. Piers, he called out.
Evidently the boy was going to cut them out as well as put them in.
He is doing so well. Guy's face brightened. He learned so fast.
There was much I could have asked, but I held my tongue. Instead, I told Guy about Belknap. He went to Dr. Archer complaining of weakness and nausea, and he has been purging and bleeding him so that there's little left of him. I feel he may die. Guy looked thoughtful.
I am afraid he would not be the first patient Archer killed with his treatment. He is the most traditional of traditionalists. Yet I ought not to take another doctor's patient.
Belknap wants a second opinion. He begins to realize Archer is doing him harm. He started with fainting and a bad stomach. I think he's quite ill now.
Belknap, I remember that name. He has done you harm in the past, has he not?
Yes, he's the greatest rogue in Lincoln's Inn. In fact, I will pay your fee, otherwise you'll have to battle for it.
I imagine he's making Archer wait for his money. You would help an enemy?
I smiled. Then he will owe me a moral debt.
I would like to see how he deals with that. Don't think my motives are of unalloyed purity. Whose are?
He looked sad, then smiled at me.
I think also you do not like to see suffering.
Perhaps. The smile faded from my face as the door opened and Piers entered, neat in his blue apprentice's robe, the usual bland, respectful expression on his handsome face.
Guy stood and touched his arm. Piers, your patient is here. Take him through to the other room, would you?
Piers bowed. Good morning, Master Shardlake. I rose reluctantly and followed him out. I had hoped Guy might come to supervise, but he stayed with his book. In the treatment room, with its shelves lined with more apothecary's jars, its long table and its racks of fearsome-looking instruments, Piers smiled and gestured to a stool beside the table.
Would you bare your arm, sir, then sit there?
I rolled up my shirt sleeve again. Piers turned and looked over Guy's instruments. I stared at his broad, blue-robed back. When Guy had praised him just now, I had seen a haunted look in his eyes, almost as though he were trying to console himself with the boy's skill. But what was he hiding? Piers selected a small pair of scissors, opened and closed them experimentally, then turned to me with a deferential smile, though I thought I saw cold amusement in his eyes. I watched apprehensively as he bent and snipped the black stitches. He did it gently, though, then took a pair of tweezers and slowly pulled out the broken threads.
I sighed with relief when it was over, the constant pulling sensation of the last few days gone.
Piers looked at my arm.
There, all is healed. It's wonderful how Dr. Moulton's poultices prevent wounds from becoming infected.
Yes, it is.
There'll be a scar, of course. It was a nasty gash.
You're learning a lot from Dr. Moulton?
Far more than from my old master,
Piers smiled.
He was one of those apothecaries who believed in exotic herbs prepared in consultation with astrological charts.
A traditionalist.
If I might dare to say it, sir, I think he wasn't quite honest. He had the dried-up body of some strange large lizard with a long tail in his shop. He would cut bits off, powder them up, and get people to take the powder. Because the lizard was so strange, patients thought it had some great power.
He gave a cynical smile that made him look older than his years.
People always believe in the power of the strange and unfamiliar. It's good to be working with Dr. Moulton now. An honest man. A man of reason.
Your old master died, I believe.
Yes.
Piers fetched down one of the jars. He opened it, and I caught the sickly smell of the ointment Guy had used before. Piers put some on the end of a spatula and touched it to my arm, spreading it gently.
It was the smallpox killed him. The strange thing was, he didn't dose himself with any of his own remedies. I think he didn't believe in them himself. He simply took to his bed and waited to see if the pox would kill him. Which it did. There, that's done, sir.
I found Piers' even unemotional tone in talking of his master's death distasteful. Had he family?
No, There was just him and me. Dr. Morton came and did what he could for him, but the smallpox takes its own path, does it not? Sometimes it kills, sometimes it disfigures. My parents died of it when I was small. I am sorry. Dr. Morton has been father and mother to me since I came here. He said he's going to help you train to become a physician.
Piers looked up sharply, perhaps wondering why I was asking, taking such an interest. He knew I didn't like him.
Yes,
he hesitated, then said,
I do appreciate all the kindness he's shown me.
Yes, his kindness is of a rare sort. I stood up. Thank you for seeing to my arm. Piers bowed.
I'm glad it's better.
I left the room. He didn't follow me. I remembered him listening at the door when we were talking of the murders. I thought, Guy might be kind, but you are not. You're cold and calculating like a predatory animal. You have some hold over my friend, and I will discover what it is. Next door, Guy was still reading his book. He offered me a glass of wine and asked to look at my arm. He nodded with satisfaction.
Piers has done a good job.
I do wonder if he possesses the human sympathy one would hope for in a physician.
He has had little chance to develop it. His parents died when he was young. And my late neighbour, Apothecary Hepton, worked him hard and taught him little.
He told me about his death. He seems to have thought little of him.
Yes. Piers can speak harshly, but I believe he has the capacity for sympathy. I believe I can teach it to him.
He says you are a father and mother to him.
Did he say that?
Guy smiled, then his expression turned somber. What are you thinking? I asked gently.
Nothing.
He changed the subject.
I have been to see Adam Kite again. You know, I think there is improvement. That woman keeper, Ellen, she works hard with him. She forces him to eat and clean himself, tries to pull him away from his obsession with constant prayer.
Did you know she's a former patient and isn't allowed to leave the precinct?
No.
Guy looked taken aback.
That surprises me.
She told me herself.
She's gentle with Adam, but very firm. It has had an effect. The other day he even talked of normal, everyday things for a minute. He said the weather is getting warmer. He didn't feel so cold. But still I cannot get him to explain why he feels such a sense of sin. I wonder what brought it on.
What do his parents say?
I saw you leave with them after the court hearing. They say they have no idea. I believe them.
Thank you for doing this.
Adam cannot be easy to work with.
Guy smiled sadly.
He touches me, yet intrigues me too. So, like you with Belknap, my motives are not all pure.
I ought to visit Adam again.
I'm going to see him again tomorrow morning. Would you like to come?
Very well, if I can.
You don't sound as if you want to.
I find it distressing. He's in such pain, and religious madness makes me think of the man we're hunting and who has been hunting me. I looked at my arm. How can he believe that what he's doing is inspired by God?
Have we not seen enough these last years to know that men may do cruel, wicked things, yet believe they have communion with God? Think of the king.
Yes. Belief in God and human sympathy can be very different things. Yet the killer is something different again. That obsessive savagery. I looked at Guy. He still has 3 murders to commit. And if he succeeds, I, like you, don't think he'll stop. I told Cramer so today.
No. Such a momentum
would have to be carried forward till he is caught or dies.
How will he feel if he pours out the 7 vials of wrath and the world doesn't end?
There have been many in these last years who thought they knew when the world would end. When it does not, they go back to Revelation for the clues they have missed. And that's easy. It's not a story in sequence, but a series of violent narratives giving alternative ways in which the world will finish. So they find a new formula.
I nodded slowly. Does he suffer, I wonder?
The killer? Guy shook his head. I do not know. My guess would be the acts of killing are a sort of ecstasy for him, but perhaps, that apart, he lives in a world of pain.
But he conceals it. He's able to live a normal life or something like it, without standing out.
Yes. I think among the many things he is a good actor.
Is it Goddard? I shook my head. I don't know.
Harsnett still thinks he's possessed.
Guy shook his head.
No. He is an obsessive. And all obsessions come from some maladjustment of the brain, not the devil.
He set his lips. I thought, why are you so sure? We were silent for a moment. Then I asked, what happens after the vials are poured out? In Revelation. What comes next? Guy rose and went to his bookshelf. He brought down a New Testament and turned to Revelation.
The 7 vials of wrath are in chapters 15 to 16. Already before then there has been another version of the end of the world, disasters coming when the 7 angels blow their trumpets.
He turned the pages with his long brown fingers.
Hail and fire, a mountain falling into the sea. But there is not such concentration on the torments of men as there is in the story of the 7 vials. Perhaps that was what attracted the killer.
He paused, turned the page.
The judgment of the great whore comes after.
When I read them, those passages seemed more obscure than most. Who is the great whore meant to be? Guy smiled sadly.
It used to be thought she symbolized the Roman Empire. But now the radicals say she represents the Church of Rome. And after that, war in heaven and Jesus' final victory.
He passed the book across to me. I had studied the passages about the 7 vials to exhaustion, but now I read on, aloud. I saw a woman sit upon a rose-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. I remembered the painting of the creature in the Westminster chapter house. And the woman was arrayed in purple and rose colour, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of whoredom and abominations of the earth. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th and is of the 7, and shall go into destruction. Her sins have reached into heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. I put the testament down with a sigh. I can make little sense of it.
Nor I.
We both jumped violently at a loud hammering on the door to the street. We exchanged glances. As Guy crossed to open it, the inner door opened and Piers came in. I wondered whether he had been listening outside again.
Who is it?
Guy called out.
It's I, Barak.
Guy threw open the door. I caught a glimpse of Suki tied to the rail beside Genesis. She was breathing heavily. Barak must have ridden here fast. There was no sign of drunkenness about him today. He was sober and alert, his expression hard and serious. He stepped inside.
There's been another killing, he said. There's some strange mystery about this one. Dr. Moulton, sir, can you come with us?